Well, thanks so much. Thank you to Laura, and thank you to a little bit more or a little bit less?
The static is still coming through.
Okay. Terry, can we do the recording without the microphone? All right. I will just use my stage voice. thank you to Laura, and to Gwen, to Fordyce, to Sasha, to the friends of the library. Thanks to all of you for coming here on a day that I thought was going to be just floating on air kind of day at an academic institution. It turned out quite different, and my title is different from what was advertised, mainly because of that. When I got up very, very early this morning because of insomnia, I realized that I wasn't sure how I was just going to give a talk on things I found out about Emily Dickinson's reading. It just didn't seem the day for that. And I got to thinking about, well, why do I do this? Why does it matter? And I got the idea to, well, I can keep most of my talk, but start off with the big question, maybe going a bit along what Laura was just saying. Why study Emily Dickinson at a time like this? One way of answering that, and actually I'll use this as maybe a lead-in to the way I want to answer this, is by referencing an essay by C.S. Lewis that he wrote during World War II called Learning in Wartime, in which he raises the question, why should we have university education while the war is on? He's writing this at Oxford while World War II is in progress. And it's a real question. People are getting drafted. People who aren't getting drafted are feeling incredible pressure to enlist. Your country needs you. So why waste your time hanging around Oxford when you could be doing something useful for your country? And he begins by saying, well, the answer is the exact same one as the answer during peacetime, because the exact same issues adhere in peacetime as well as in war. The issues are just more obvious during wartime. In the current climate in higher education, it seems like that kind of constant war mentality might be a useful way for us to think about our position in society. So that means we need to ask the question, why do we do this? We need to keep thinking about this. We need to keep answering it for ourselves. To start moving toward an answer, I'd like to start with poetry. One of the things that I noticed today as I brought myself to open up social media, see what was going on, was that people were quoting a lot, and poetry in many cases. Some poems of hope, some poems of darkness. And it got me thinking about why we turn to poems at times like this, and what poems we turn to at times like this. The poems that came to my mind, I'd like to share with you. The first one by the poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, late 19th century British writer, a sonnet he wrote titled God's Grandeur. The world is full of the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning, at the brown brink eastward springs. Because the Holy Ghost o'er the bent world broods with warm breast and with bright wings. One other poem that came to mind is by Isaac Watts, who I'll talk about a little bit more in a moment. This is not one of his best known pieces, but it's one of his hundreds of hymns that he wrote in the early 18th century. Now shall my inward joys arise and burst into a song. Almighty love inspires my heart, and pleasure tunes my tongue. God on his thirsty Zion hill some mercy drops has thrown, and solemn oaths have bound his love to bring salvation down. Why do we then indulge our fears, suspicions, and complaints? Is he a God, and shall his grace grow weary of his saints? Can a kind mother e'er forget the infant of her womb? Amid a thousand tender thoughts, her suckling have no room. Yet, saith the Lord, should nature change and mothers monsters prove, Zion still dwells upon the heart of everlasting love. Deep on the palms of both my hands I have engraved her name. My hands shall rebuild her broken walls, restore her broken frame. Now, maybe something in those poems strike a chord for you. Maybe there's more distance than anything else that comes of this. How do we deal with these poems of faith from the 19th century, a time that feels to us, maybe in this moment, so much simpler, so much kinder, so much more innocent? I'm going to try to put a little bit of pressure on our notions of what was going on in the 19th century, but especially I want to put pressure on what we think Emily Dickinson was doing as a poet, particularly what was she doing in relation to the religious material and especially the hymns that circulated in her time. As Laura was saying, hymns were everywhere in the 19th century. You couldn't pick up pretty much any print genre without running into them. They would even show up on little note cards that people would have, maybe even business cards that people handed out. These are texts that would be sung, would be spoken, would be memorized and recited. And they're generally acknowledged as being in the air because you can't completely ignore them. But there hasn't been all that much done on what Dickinson had to do with hymns, or perhaps what hymns had to do with Dickinson. There's been much work done on her reading in transcendentalist philosophy, in science, in magazine reading, newspapers, travel writing, Shakespeare, so on and so forth. But on hymns, the definitive statement came in 1954 from Thomas Johnson, who was one of Dickinson's first major biographers. And he says in that work, quote, basically, all her poems employ meters derived from English hymnology. They were the metric forms familiar to her from childhood as the measures in which Watts's hymns were composed. Copies of Watts's Christian Psalmody, or his collection of the Psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, were fixtures in every New England household. Both were owned by Edward Dickinson, her father, and are inscribed with his name. Emily Dickinson's own experimentation went beyond anything envisioned by the formal precisionists who edited Watts's hymns and songs. But the interesting point is that she did not have to step outside her father's library to receive a beginner's lesson in metrics. That's it. Her father owned two books. There are Watts hymns in them, and she learned meter from them. That's the definitive statement on Emily Dickinson and hymns. Doesn't say much about what she did with the content of these, what the Dickinsons did with the content of these, what these books were like, what they contained, what they didn't contain. And so that's what I want to have us explore a little bit in the time that we have here. And eventually this will build back to this why question. Why bother with all of this? I promise you there is a reason for doing it. One thing also that I want to highlight from that line from Johnson, he emphasizes that Dickinson learned this in her father's library. One of the things I'm going to highlight here is the different members of the Dickinson family, what their relationship to hymn books were, and how Emily may have had access to books through them. Edward Dickinson was one source, probably not the most important source, certainly not the only source of hymns. So this is the 1950s that Johnson says this. 30 years later, Barton St. Armand, another Dickinson scholar, makes a statement that she transforms, quote, Puritan hymnology into personal psalmody. A little less precise than what Johnson told us about meter. The Puritan hymnology, as Meredith will know, is a very weird phrase to use, and might become a bit clearer later on why that phrase is so weird. But this idea that there is a consensus, Puritan. There's something Puritan that all Puritans, presumably including Edward Dickinson and his church, agree on, and Emily comes up with something personal in response to that. We'll see how that holds up. Particularly, I want us to start thinking about what is happening with Isaac Watts. I'm going to talk about Watts for a little bit, which Laura, I know, will be very happy about. I'm going to then move to my research into the Dickinson's books that survive, some at Harvard, some at Brown University today, but the family's collection is still largely intact. And then finish with a discussion of some of Emily Dickinson's poems. Hopefully this will not keep us here too long. So Isaac Watts, a name that might be familiar to a number of you. He's often referred to as the father of English hymnody. He was very much a man who defined an era. He was born the year that John Milton died. So if we think of Puritanism, there's one heritage that we can think of. He lived to see the Great Awakening in the 1730s and 1740s, the wave of revivals that Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield are associated with, and that spread from the American colonies to England, Scotland, and Wales. By the time the Great Awakening was raging, we might say, it was fueled by Isaac Watts' hymns and psalms. He had published these a generation before, however. His first book he published as a young London pastor. He was an independent minister, not an Anglican, was in 1706, a book called Horae Lyricae, basic sacred lyrics, just religious poems, not intended as hymns, but some devotional theme. The year after, he published Hymns and Spiritual Songs, which he intended for church use, which was really weird at the time, and I'll get into why that is in just a moment. 1715, his next major work comes out. This is Divine Songs Attempted in Easy Language for Children. I'm going to talk about that a bit more in a moment, but the one that I want to really start with here is his next book, The Psalms of David Imitated in the Language of the New Testament. It comes out in 1719. There are two big things that I want to highlight. There are many, many things we could say about Isaac Watts. He was a very influential educator. He was a very influential pastor, actually kind of a celebrity preacher in his time. He was a very popular children's author and, as I said, the father of English hymnody. The two big things I want to bring out here that help us to understand what Dickinson may have gotten from this man besides metrics. He connected the Psalms with modern personal experience. And he voiced some of his poetry as a child, acknowledging the worth of the child reader. So I'll come back to each of the, to what it is that I want to get at with these. This idea of Psalms with a modern personal experience. So if you are English and you are Protestant before, say, about 1800, you are almost certainly capital R Reformed. That means that you come from a tradition that follows the teachings of John Calvin. This is true for the Anglicans, it's true for the Independents, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, even the Unitarians, to some degree will take their point of departure from the Calvinists. And one of the things that Calvin teaches is that in a worship service, you can only use the Word of God for the service. Now, the sermon is expanding on the Word of God, but when you're singing, those texts have to be inspired. They can't just be written by anybody. So that means that almost everything being sung in the churches is psalms. And when Watts is growing up in his church, they only sing psalms. And because they're singing psalms, because they're the Word of God, one of the big goals for most translators, not all, but most translators who are being used in churches, is to get as close to the original text as possible while still writing it in rhymed meter. It's a very difficult kind of thing to pull off. Let me give you an example of how this plays out. Here's the beginning of Psalm 98 from the King James Bible, which comes out 1611. O sing unto the Lord a new song, for he hath done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm hath gotten him the victory. The Lord hath made known his salvation. His righteousness hath he openly showed in the sight of the heathen. He hath remembered his mercy and his truth toward the house of Israel. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. Now one of the psalm book versions, one of the sung versions. This is actually taken from a book called The Whole Book of Psalms. We now call it the Bay Psalm Book. It was the first book printed in British America, 1640. It was translated by a team of Boston clergy who wanted the most literal, rhymed translation of the Bible they could get. Very difficult because the original Hebrew doesn't rhyme. Here's what they wound up with for that same passage. A new song sing unto the Lord, for wonders he hath done. His right hand and his holy arm him victory hath won. Jehovah his salvation hath made for to be known. His righteousness in the heathen's sight he openly hath shown. To Israel's house of his mercy and truth hath mindful been. In the ends of all the earth they have our God's salvation seen. Now, Watts, when he decided to do the Psalms, did not want a literal translation. He wanted a relevant translation. And so he calls his book the Psalms imitated in the language of the New Testament. There are a couple of things he really wanted to get at. The first is that Christians, while being the spiritual descendants of the nation of Israel, are not, in fact, Israelites. They have the New Testament. They have the salvation story of Christ that continues the Old Testament, according to their teaching. So to have everybody sing only in Jewish Old Testament modes in church when the sermon is based on the gospel in the New Testament, to Watts, doesn't really make sense. We need to make these things Christian. We also need to make them relevant. These are the words for the church today, not just for the Hebrews at one point, and we can just kind of keep following after them. So when he gets to moments talking about the nation of Israel, he switches that to Britain. When it refers to the king, that's King George. He brings this up to date. Or when he's first, 1719, he's mainly talking about King George at that point. And so when he does Psalm 98, it sounds very, very different. Joy to the world. The Lord has come. Let earth receive her king. Let every heart prepare him room, and heaven and nature sing. It's a little different. Did not start as a Christmas hymn. It started as a psalm paraphrase. But Watts wanted to bring this much more compactly and in a much more modern vein to readers, and apparently it caught on. He did this with not all, but most of the psalms, and his hymns did similar kinds of exegesis with other scriptural texts. One of the arguments he tries to make when he tries to convince churches to use hymns in worship is that, look, this lets you use more of the Bible. That hymn that I recited at the beginning is based on Isaiah 45. There are many other scripture passages that you can now bring into the service if you're willing to just kind of drop your Calvinist guard a little bit. And this becomes very important for Emily Dickinson, who is very well-versed in the Bible, who is very well-versed in the traditions of the church, but who has her own ways of making these modern, of making these stories and tropes relevant. And I would argue that she gets her point of departure there from Watts. Watts, rather than being a foil for her to react to, gives her an example of how you can move from the literal to the real and the relevant. Now, for children's verse, this Divine Songs book that I mentioned was ahead of its time. There were people who wrote for children before Watts came along. There was a popular collection of children's poems, for instance, by John Bunyan, the author of Pilgrim's Progress, that came out a few years after Pilgrim's Progress did. But this is still, in 1715, when his Divine Songs comes out, 30 years before most scholars will say children's literature really began. The usual start point with that is a publisher, which is strange in literary history. It's, I think, the only literary history that really starts with a publisher, John Newbery, in the 1740s in London, with Goody Two-Shoes and these other stories that he produces in a series, are the beginning of children's literature. Telling the story that way neglects that the Divine Songs was the number one most reprinted children's title in the 18th century. It was also, from what we can tell, the number one most reprinted children's title in the 19th century. Not going to go into the Alice in Wonderland references here. We could pick that up in Q&A if people are interested. But the reason why Carol picks that up is because these things are everywhere in the 19th century. Children recite them. They learn how to read from Watts's Divine Songs. In fact, Newbery himself uses some of the Divine Songs in his primer that he produces, which is very popular on both sides of the Atlantic. Watts is part of how he puts his literacy instruction together. And something that is very important for Dickinson, other than the fact she clearly knows these, and one of the ways that we know she knows them, is that the second earliest surviving poem of hers, A Comic Valentine, she writes when she's in her early 20s, includes the line, "How doth the little busy bee," which is part of the same song that Alice tries and fails to recite in the Alice in Wonderland books. But what is different about Watts is rather than trying to simply talk to the child, little children, do this, don't do that, the kind of thing that you tend to hear from, say, people like John Bunyan, he tries to write as a child in most of his songs. So even when he's trying to teach in a way that if a child says this, the child can make this his or her own, not be talked down to, but learn to grow into whatever's being taught. This was revolutionary for the time. Let me give you an example of how this works. This is song one from the Divine Songs. How glorious is our heavenly King who reigns above the sky? How shall a child presume to sing his dreadful majesty? How great his power is, none can tell, nor think how large his grace. Not men below, nor saints that dwell on high before his face. Not angels that stand round the Lord can search his secret will. But they perform his heavenly word and sing his praises still. Then let me, the child, join this holy train and my first offerings bring. The eternal God will not disdain to hear an infant sing. My heart resolves, my tongue obeys, and angels shall rejoice to hear their mighty maker's praise sound from a feeble voice. It's that feeble voice that becomes very important for Dickinson, the voice that is not quite heard, the voice that can't quite reach to the lover, to the father, to the relative, to Christ. It keeps trying to over and over in her poems, and it doesn't. And this is often rendered as a child's voice. One of her earlier poems in her major phase, she really kind of kicks into high gear around 1860. There are about 1,800 surviving Dickinson poems. About two-thirds of those are written between 1860 and 1865. She lives from 1830 to 1886, just to give you an idea. Something kicks in during the Civil War that really gets a hold of her. But in one of these early poems, she creates a speaker, and her speakers are very tricky to talk about. We want these to be Emily Dickinson when we see I in a poem, and it isn't Emily Dickinson. Some are closer, some are farther away, especially if she's speaking to family members. She's writing some of these poems for family members. They expect that to be Emily Dickinson sometimes, not always. There's a whole other lecture we could give on lyric address in Dickinson. That's not what we're here for today. The poem that I want to read that highlights one particular speaker brings in a second character called Tim that seems to have some resemblance to Tiny Tim from Dickens. This is, by the way, if you want to follow along, the Franklin edition, this is number 231. We don't cry, Tim and I. We are far too grand. But we bolt the door tight to prevent a friend. Then we hide our brave face deep in our hand. Not to cry, Tim and I, we're far too grand. Nor to dream, he and me, do we condescend. We just shut our brown eye to see to the end. Tim, see cottages, but oh, so high. Then we shake, Tim and I, and lest I cry, Tim reads a little hymn, and we both pray, please, sir, I and Tim always lost the way. We must die by and by, clergymen say. Tim shall, if I do, I too, if he. How shall we arrange it? Tim was so shy. Take us simultaneous, Lord, I, Tim, and me. This desperate prayer to God at the end comes out of this prayer that is begun by reading a little hymn in order to stave off this fear of death and fear of separation that's hovering over these two characters. What Reed's a little what is Reed's a little hymn about? I want us now to turn to the Dickinson family books and see if we can figure out a bit what this language of reading hymns is about. One of the major scholars, I think one of the best Dickinson scholars active today, Christan Miller, said in a book a few years ago that when Dickinson uses says the line "hymn from pulpit read," that's referring to a sermon. I think we might arrive at another interpretation as we dig a little bit into these books. The most famous Dickinson hymn book that a number of Johnson talks about, the Dad's books. The most famous one that other scholars have talked about, though, is one owned by Emily Norcross Dickinson. This is Emily, the poet Emily Elizabeth Dickinson's mother. She has a copy of Watts's Psalms and Hymns bound together in one volume, which was pretty common in the 19th century, an 1810 copy that she had before she was married. Her signature is in it, Emily Norcross. And one of the things that I think is really important about this book is that it's starting to show us that even when you're dealing with Watts, hymns don't hold still. The tradition of hymns is very fluid. It's very dynamic. And what's dynamic about this one is that this is Joel Barlow's revision of Isaac Watts's Psalms. I mentioned before that Watts wanted to update Israel to Britain and the crown to George. This was great for colonists during the Great Awakening. It was a little bit embarrassing after independence. And so in 1785, the Association of Connecticut Congregationalists commissioned Joel Barlow, who was a famous poet in Connecticut at the time, to rewrite the Watts Psalms so that they would be a bit more American. And this was a very, very popular version. It was available for Presbyterians in the Mid-Atlantic. It was available for Congregationalists and Unitarians in New England. And this is a book that was clearly well-loved, well-used. There are a lot of pages folded down, a lot of corners folded down in this book. But again, these are not the original Watts texts. These are now updated Watts texts that her mother is living with for decades and decades and decades. As far as Edward's books, he has an 1817 copy of Christian Psalmody, one of the ones that Johnson refers to, and an 1834 copy of Samuel Worcester's edition of what he calls Watson Select. There are a whole bunch of Watson Select books. The basic idea with these is that you take all, or if you can't deal with quite all, most of Watts, the Psalms and the hymns, and then you have an extra section in the back that gives you what's happened since. So maybe people like Charles Wesley, or John Newton, or Phil Doddridge, or you know, whoever else might be a popular hymn for your particular crowd. The Christian Psalmody book is especially significant because 1817, the year it comes out, is the last time we know that First Church Amherst, the Dickinson family church, held a singing school to help people learn new tunes, for congregations to learn more music because it wasn't taught in schools yet. Pastors would encourage people to organize singing schools that would last for maybe a few weeks at a time. You would buy a tune book, and you would learn some tunes from it. There would be a concert at the end of that, and that's often where choirs came from. People who graduate from these singing schools say, hey, we want to keep going. Let's organize a choir for church, and that's where choirs really emerge from in America. Christian Psalmody was one of the texts used for that singing school, and there was an 80-page appendix of tunes put in the back. You had all text before then, which was how standard hymn books were done at the time, and then there was music in the back. Edward Dickinson's copy does not have the music in it. Why is that? Well, if we look at some of the other books, we might start to figure out a pattern that might explain why. The book that Emily grew up with was a book called Church Psalmody. So we've got Christian Psalmody back in the 18-teens, Church Psalmody in the early 1830s. Hymn book titles get really screwy. They're so close together. Church Psalmody is a book put together by Lowell Mason, who's probably the number one congregational singing advocate in the U.S. He's the guy who starts getting music education in schools, starting in Boston in the 1820s and continuing on from there across the nation. He collaborates with a man named David Green to put this together. It's words only. There's no music in it. And it's essentially an expanded Watson Select. There's a whole lot of Watts, so that Congregationalists and Baptists and Presbyterians will buy it. And then there's a lot of Wesley, and there's a lot of these other kinds of texts that are popular at the time. Emily Dickinson quotes hymns in a number of her letters. it's debatable whether she ever quotes Watts. There's this one that some people think is a misquotation of Watts. It's a little hard to tell whether that's actually Watts or not. But she definitely quotes from a translation of a St. Augustine hymn. She quotes from the English Moravian James Montgomery. She quotes from the Anglican William Cooper. And she also quotes from the English Unitarian Anna Letitia Barbauld, one of the most popular female hymn writers of the time. And these are all available in that Church Psalmody book. The next book that the congregation adopts does have music in it. Starting in the late 1850s, you finally have from this hymn book, words only over here, tune book that the singing schools and the choirs are using over here, finally merges into what we think of as a modern hymnal. The problem is a lot of people don't like it. And so in the 1850s, when these books start to come out, you have to produce them in two editions, one with the music in it and one without. The music one is a lot heavier, it's a lot more expensive, and it messes up your reading. So when First Church adopts the Sabbath Hymn and Tune Book, another Lowell Mason project that he does with a couple of Andover Seminary professors, it's nicknamed the Andover Collection, the Dickinsons buy several copies. They rent a pew in the church, they keep a few copies for the family to use in the pews, they have a few that they keep home. They're all the Sabbath Hymn book. None of them are the Sabbath Hymn and Tune book. The Dickinsons seem never to have owned, or at least they haven't survived, any hymn books with music in them. Why? Presumably because they like to read in them. One of the things that happens with those singing schools is that as people get excited about this new music, they're learning more tunes, they're learning three-part harmony and four-part harmony, they're learning fugues, all these kinds of great things. They get really excited, they want to do these. They sit in a group up in the front of the church, not in a choir loft, but just kind of the front pews. And they sing, and nobody else who wasn't part of the singing school can follow them. So they're out happily singing the hymn, and everybody else just gradually gets used to just sitting with their books that only have words, and they read while the choir is singing. And this seems to be exactly what the Dickinsons were accustomed to in church. Wasn't at all unusual for this to happen. And it gives us a new way of thinking about a famous letter that Dickinson sends to her friend and future sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert, in 1852. She says, "When I was gone to meeting, you filled my mind so full I could not find a chink to put the worthy pastor. When he said, 'Our Heavenly Father,' I said, 'Oh, darling Sue.' When he read the 100th Psalm, I kept saying 'your precious letter' all over to myself. And Susie, when they sang, it would have made you laugh to hear one little voice piping to the departed. I made up words and kept singing how I loved you, and you had gone while all the rest of the choir were singing hallelujahs. I presume nobody heard me because I sang so small," she underlined, "so small. But it was a kind of a comfort to think that I might put them out singing of you." She didn't sing out loud. This was all in her head. While the choir say, there's no evidence that Emily Dickinson ever joined the choir at Amherst. She did join the choir at Holyoke while she was there, but she did never join the choir at First Church Amherst, and in fact would stop going to services in the late 1850s from what we can tell. But in this space where, first of all, the minister is reading the text out, so here's where we get the hymn from pulpit read. The standard thing was to what was called give out the text. The pastor would read the hymn or the psalm that was about to be sung, then it would be sung, the choir would pipe up, and everybody else would pipe down. And so Emily is sitting in a ready-made, private, silent space for herself in the middle of a church service to fantasize, to create poetry. We tend to read this letter as her trying to subvert the church service. She's not trying to subvert the church. She's actually using what the church service affords for her to do. And a related kind of privacy is reflected in another set of books that wind up in the Dickinson family. And these are books that are in Susan Gilbert, who that letter was written to, becomes Susan Gilbert Dickinson when she marries her Emily's brother, Austin. Susan Dickinson collected what I like to call private hymn books. And I have a couple of examples over here. If people want to come up and take a look at these afterwards, feel free to do so. These are generally handsomely produced. This one, Hymns of the Ages, is produced by Tickner and Fields, who is the preeminent literary publisher in Boston in the mid-19th century. They publish Longfellow, they publish Hawthorne, they publish Emerson, they publish Thoreau, they publish Stowe. You can go on. Basically, if you've heard of them and they're New Englanders in the 19th century, they probably published them at some point. This is a collection largely of older hymns, and by older, we're talking about Catholic, maybe even Orthodox, pre-Reformation texts, edited by two women. Caroline Snowdon Whitmarsh and Anne Guild, with a lovely frontispiece engraving. Again, you'll be able to see this much better up close. But this is after a J.M.W. Turner design. Pretty high production values on this particular book. This is so popular, it winds up going into three volumes collecting all this kind of material. Each one goes through several printings. This is a mainstay on the gift book market during the late 1850s, first comes out in 59, continues through most of the 1860s. It's so popular that Whitmarsh winds up doing another project with another Boston publisher, Walker and Fuller, Hymns for Mothers and Children, which is so popular it goes into a second volume, 1861 and 1865. And this one has, again, a marvelous frontispiece of a mother reading a hymn book to her children while they crawl all over her. You know, that is 1860s domestic bliss right there. These collections include things that we wouldn't necessarily think of as hymns. They certainly don't seem to fit the denominational requirements. The doctrinal content of these is all over the place. The eras are all over the churches. You know, Catholics, not very popular among Boston Protestants at this point. Orthodox, who knows anything about the Orthodox in 1860s Boston? Moravians, Lutherans, all these different traditions are represented in these books. And in Hymns for Mothers and Children in particular, these are texts that celebrate home life in particular, that celebrate family bonds, that celebrate nature. And even in the second volume that I have, there's a section on fairies. It's kind of an interesting, you know, hymns about fairies, how that works. This is obviously a very capacious sense of hymn. It's being packaged for people who like hymns, who want to read more hymns, but are okay with reading things that maybe are not strictly hymns in the church sense, because you can read them as hymns in the comfort of your own home. And these books are only meant to be read at home. That's why I call them private hymn books. They are never to be used in church. Susan Dickinson had two of the three Hymns of the Ages volumes, both given to her by the man who wrote the preface, Frederick Dan Huntington, who at the time was a Harvard professor, eventually converted to Episcopalianism from Unitarianism and became Bishop of Syracuse. Hymns for Mothers and Children, we don't know when she got these, but she owned both of the volumes. And the second one I want to spend just a little bit of time on to lead into a discussion of some of Dickinson's poems. And I'll read just a couple of those and then stop for some questions and answers. Whitmarsh complains in her preface to the first Hymns for Mothers and Children of, compared to the Hymns of the Ages, where there are these marvelous archival volumes that are coming out of translated Latin texts, all these things, there's a, quote, sad lack of material for finding things suitable for domestic use, especially talking about domestic scenes. She says that most of her material actually came either from taking dictation from children reciting their favorite texts or from actually having to borrow books from children themselves. For, she says, quote, there are no Athenaeum libraries of children's books, and this book has literally been gathered out of the mouths of babes. Now, these books are not on Johnson's radar. They're not owned by the father. They're owned by a female member of the family. Emily had easy access to these. She looked at Susan's books a lot. And they're about the domestic scene, which we tend to think, you know, Dickinson didn't really write about that. She wrote about other things. Well, actually, she was very, very concerned with the domestic scene. She spent most of her life not writing poetry, but in the domestic scene, taking care of an invalid mother, taking care of various relatives, finding out what was happening in different lives. And she was a profoundly devoted aunt to the three children that Susan and Austin had, the first one being born in 1861. Ned, the first Hymns for Mothers and Children, may possibly have been a mother's first Christmas gift for Susan. That's one plausible way of understanding what was happening there. There's been basically no scholarship on what becoming an aunt might have done for Dickinson. There's been a lot done on her possible romantic relationships, on her tensions with her father, with her brother, with different people, but nothing about these very profound relationships she has with these three little people. And there's also been very little commentary on poem number 198, which is written in the year that Ned is born, which gives us a bit of a sense of what a baby might have done to Dickinson's poetry. It actually starts with that word, baby. Teach him, when he makes the names, such a one, to say, on his babbling, berry lips, as should sound, to me, were my ear as near his nest as my thought today, as should sound, forbid us not, some like Emily. This is a classic form of Dickinsonian compression and indirection. It's very hard to figure out, hearing it out loud, what's going on. But let me just touch on a few layers fairly quickly what's going on here. She's talking about teaching the baby to say her name, to say Emily. But in the process, there are two ways you can read that. Either a parent teach the baby how to speak, or starting with the word baby, the baby teach us to speak the names. And the line that shows up right before some like Emily, forbid us not, in quotation marks. The reference to a story that shows up in most of the Gospels when parents are bringing their children for Jesus to bless. And the disciples said, no, he's too busy, go away. And Jesus said, no, suffer the little children to come to me and forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of heaven. One way of reading this poem is to ask the baby to intercede to Jesus, this person that Dickinson keeps trying and failing to connect with in her poetry, for her. Again, there's more that we could do with this poem, but this starts to give us a sense how she's working with this idea of the baby. What is my relationship to the baby? What is the baby's relationship to God? How do all these things work together? She's working this out as she's moving into aunthood. Now, she is also perfectly happy not only to play around with Bible texts like that, but she also will play around with Watts. One of the most famous examples, and this is a lighter, more humorous example, she takes a Watts stanza. Faith is the brightest evidence of things beyond our sight, breaks through the clouds of flesh and sense, and dwells in heavenly light. This is an expression of what Jonathan Edwards would call the divine and supernatural light. God hits you with knowledge, and you understand. It's not from you, it's from somewhere else. Dickinson takes that stanza and does this, number 202. Faith, she puts in quotation marks, is a fine invention for gentlemen who see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency. That's the whole poem. This is generally read as, well, she's turning from religion to science. Like, well, okay, you can have faith if you want, but it's really good. You know, you want your doctor to use a microscope, not just his faith. You want to make sure that he gets that test right, you know, all these kinds. Well, yes, that is certainly, I think, at play here. There's another way we can think about this, though, since the original text is about faith is when you get it, when you have that moment. It's about that conversion experience that is so precious to Watts's time and to people all the way up into Dickinson's time. This is one thing that really bugs her during her time at Holyoke. There's a revival at Holyoke. Many people are having conversion experiences, and she can't get there. And it really bothers her. She writes, you know, I wish I could. I wish I could figure out how to do this. So it's not just that, well, people, I don't know, these Jesus freaks are around doing that. I don't know what's going on. She's trying to figure out how to get into that, and she can't. So she finds her own way in other poems, but she also wrestles with this fact that she can't quite get in. She uses this image of the locked door, of the missed connection, the missed message, over and over and over again. One example of how she finds a way for herself, and I'm getting a little long here, but I will wrap up with this poem and then say a little bit about why we should be thinking about all this. Number 525. My period had come for prayer. No other art would do. My tactics missed a rudiment. Creator, was it you? God grows above, so those who pray horizons must ascend. And so I stepped upon the north to see this curious friend. His house was not. No sign had he by chimney nor by door. Could I infer his residence, vast prairies of air unbroken by a cellar, were all that I could see. Infinitude. Hadst thou no face that I might look on thee? So here she's lost again, but there's one more stanza. The silence condescended. Creation stopped for me. Remember, death does not stop for her, or she could not stop for it. Creation stopped for me. But awed by my errand, I worshipped, did not pray. Which again, she puts in quotation marks. So she finds this spirituality in nature. She finds this connection through silence, through meditation, possibly even through reading. Again, this is the kind of hymnody that's going on in the Whitmarsh books, not what's going on necessarily in the church books, although you can find dimensions of that if you go looking for it. And so what we start to see here is what we might call a post-secular Dickinson, this idea that sacred and secular as a binary don't really tell us what's going on here. She's trying to see, where do these things intermingle? How do these things work together? Where can I find a way through both of these things? And so we could say that Dickinson may in fact have been writing hymns, these private hymns, these domestic hymns, because the line between hymn and poem becomes almost trivial at the point where you're trying to figure out how to connect with meaning, how to connect with the divine. Do it through nature, do it through family, through the baby, through the flower. And so why should we be thinking about this at a time like this? I think we need to understand that her relationship to religion and its expressions are about possibilities, not about dichotomies. The general line is that Dickinson was reacting to Puritan orthodoxy. This is, again, what's going on in St. Armand's phrase, the Puritan hymnology. Puritans didn't have hymnology. They had psalmody. But to say, well, there's this Puritan thing she has to react to, this is often tied, and Johnson helps to make this connection, to Dickinson's father, seeing him as a fire and brimstone breathing Calvinist. He actually wasn't. He was a good Whig. And a good Whig in the 1840s, 1850s knows that Jesus wants you to support Henry Clay's American plan. His version of Christianity was what we today might call Christian nationalism, not Puritanism. And so when she pushes back against an Orthodox foil, what she tends to be pushing back against is that sense of being an American citizen makes you a good Christian, and vice versa. That it's about this prosperity, it's about this certain kind of success and decorum. She said, no, there's got to be something else. I keep trying to get to it. I can't get to it, but I know it's there. She's actually much closer to, say, a Kierkegaard figure than to someone like Ralph Waldo Emerson in that way. In fact, she has some serious problems with her father's politics. People talk about the religion, but also the politics. The same summer that she writes that letter to Susan, she writes another one that is sent via the father, Edward Dickinson, who is a Whig delegate to the nominating convention in 1852. He's off to nominate Henry Clay. Actually, he might be voting for Webster, but you know, they wind up nominating Clay. And she says in a postscript to this letter to Susan, why can't I be a delegate to the great Whig convention? Don't I know all about Daniel Webster and the tariff and the law? Then, Susie, I could see you during a pause in the session, but I don't like this country at all, and I shan't stay here any longer. Delenda est, America, Massachusetts, and all. She's referring there to a famous line that Roman orators used to use, such as Cato, Carthago delenda est, Carthage must be destroyed. We don't tend to think of Dickinson as being too politically militant, but she has some serious problems with what she sees going on. And she wants to see the whole thing blow up, which is what we've just seen. And so in thinking about where this fits for all of us, the tradition of scholarly readings of Emily Dickinson have tended to be, and this is something that I just realized today, so I'm trying this out. Tell me if you think this doesn't work. Is a very blue state Dickinson, a very secular Dickinson, a very post-church Dickinson, who's off into philosophy and free thinking and into nature and the things that you would rather be doing besides church. But she is very, very deeply tapped into the exact same spiritual liturgical traditions and using the same spiritual liturgical traditions as the Red Stater Christian nationalists do. Her father died very suddenly in the 1870s. She spent the afternoon with him the day before, which was not their usual way. And a lot of that afternoon she spent playing at the piano and singing hymns to him. And writes to her cousins, one of the ones she sang was "Servant of God, well done, rest from thy loved employ." James Montgomery hymn, one of her father's favorites. It was not at all weird for her, 20 years or 15 years after she'd stopped going to church, to sit and sing hymns for her father, because she knew he would enjoy them. She seemed to enjoy them along with him. We can't put her very easily into a secular box or a sacred box. She is the heritage of all of America. And if we start to look for those shared origins in people like Dickinson, maybe we can start to understand where the common ground might be that can start to move us from the moment that we find ourselves in right now. Hopefully we can learn from Dickinson how to question with play and with discipline and with grace. Thank you.